Thank you, Rabbi Stuhlberger. I don't know about the blood, but it certainly took guts in those days to work in this community. I wonder if it still takes guts, but that's a different discussion. Before I begin, I would like to acknowledge that the timing of this event, in my mind, is something very special. I said Kaddish this evening because it's the yahrzeit of an individual who was in the early days very instrumental in a lot of the ability that we had to develop. The name of the individual is Dr. George Smigel, Reb Gershon Bereb Meir Be'er. He happened to have been an eighth generation descendant of the Vilna Goyim. And he helped us in many ways, but literally 10 days before he passed away, he was privileged to make a major donation, which he didn't even live to see it happen, but since it was a commitment in his lifetime, it superseded all of the obligations of his will, and the Valley Torah received that money. I understand they were still arguing in court for many years later, maybe even 15 years, but Baruch Hashem. So he had a big schus in the very last days of his life. But I wanted to tell you one interesting story that he told me about his youth. And to me it was very interesting to see just is so many examples that we see in our lives, but to see something and hear something from the time of the Bolshevik Revolution. He grew up, he was a young man in the early, I guess that was, 1917, 18, around those years. And he was a teenager. His father, it seems, was very influential, wealthy, and politically connected, and was very close with the Tsar. The Bolsheviks, were attempting to undermine the power from the Tsars. And one day he walks into his house and he sees his mother in a corner of a room with these thugs, I guess you would call them, standing there with bayonets. Bayonet is, I guess it's that long gun with a knife at the end, with the knife pointed right at the neck of his mother. And the sight was unbearable to him. And he jumps in, even though these guys outnumbered him and they had weapons. And he jumps in and starts fighting with them to save his mother's life. They subdued him. They took him captive. And since in their minds, they were running an alternative government because this was a revolution that was going on, they tried him for treason. And they convicted him to death. He was put to death. He was to be put to death tomorrow morning. And that was the decision of this phony tribunal. The next morning, they take him out into a field, into a yard, and one of the young rebels is going to do the honors of shooting him. And he's standing in front of him with that gun, and he looks him in the face and he says, "Do you remember me?" So he says, "No. Who are you?" Says, "About 3 years ago, we were in high school together, and I was very poor. And I asked you, I didn't have money to get a haircut, and I needed a new shirt or something, and you gave it to me. I want to pay you back. Run for your life." Now, when you think about it, there are people in the world who would say, what a coincidence that this young man, who happened to be someone who a few years before, he had given a couple of, whatever the currency was, rubles, I don't know what he gave him, in order to get a haircut and maybe get a new shirt, and who would be there at the time when his life was at stake to be the one privileged to shoot him to death, other than this young man who felt guilty, who felt obligated, who felt some form of appreciation and saved his life and let him go. This man lived on, Dr. Smigel, lived on to a ripe old age. He told an interesting story about how he got out of Russia altogether. He says he ran for his life. He had no possessions. He had nothing. And he knew he had to get out because they would find him the minute they found out that this guy didn't kill him. So he found there's a train going to the border. And he got on the train and he said, my whole life, he was a very smart man, goes to the conductor and says, my whole life I've been waiting to shovel coal. That was the dream of his life. He says, maybe I can get on, because he didn't have any money for a ticket. Maybe I can get on this train and I could work on the train to shovel the coal. Okay, so he let him on and he's shoveling coal. I don't know if you've ever seen what a person looks like when he finishes shoveling coal for a day or two or a number of hours. And it was all over. He gets to the border, and now what? The border is closed. There are fences all across. There are armed guards all across the border, and there's no way out. And now he's finished. He's going to have to go back and go through the same thing over again. So he figures that the first thing that he has to do is to wash up. He can't walk around like this. So he asks one of the guards, he says, is there a bathroom here, an outhouse, or someplace where I can wash up? He says, yeah, right over there. He goes over there, he washes up, and then he notices something very, very peculiar. There's a window in this outhouse. Guess to where? To freedom, to the other side of the border. And he jumps out the window. He became a free man, and he lived to tell this story. And I just thought that if we can gain any inspiration from an individual who witnessed that he was an old man and he says, I saw the hand of God so many times in my life. And that gave him that sense that God is with him, was with him, has been with him, and will always be with him. And his neshama should have an aliyah and should be an inspiration for us. You know, we live in a rough world. Young people growing up in this world are hopefully a little bit shielded from everything that's going on. But it's really a rough place. The level of unhappiness that we find in this world is appalling. The extent of the people who are just miserable with their lives, taking their lives and so many. In the last 2 days ago, I dealt just like this, and I'm not a professional in mental health, I'm not a professional anything. I dealt with two situations of threatened suicide, serious ones. It's a crazy world we live in. It's people are just not happy. And I wonder why, you know, because it's a world where everybody is looking for happiness. Everyone's pursuing happiness. More workshops, more books. Everybody is trying to be happy. Everybody wants to be happy. And yet, we're not too successful. There's a community not too far from here. In fact, very close. I don't want to mention the name in case anybody lives there and I don't want to be offensive. That one would think that should be the happiest place in the world. In that community, there are more parties, wild parties, in one night than probably in the whole state of California in a month. People there are doing everything that anyone ever dreamt of doing to enjoy the thrills of life. And yet, in this maybe, I would call it party capital of the world, there's more misery in that community than any place that you could imagine. That's a community where the suicide rate has been the highest in the state for years. That's a community where the divorce rate is off the charts. That's a community where the rates that mental health professionals charge is beyond anything one could imagine. And it seems that many people there have a few mental health professionals in case one guy is busy 1 week, in case somebody goes on vacation, I'm not sure. And that community invented the concept, which is now taken on a little bit in the world, of the canine shrink. I don't know if you know what a shrink is. I don't know if you know what canine, you know. They bring their pets to a pet psychologist because the depression is so deep, is so overwhelming, that it's literally passed on to their house pets as well. I don't know about their goldfish, but their dogs and their cats. And it's such a sad place. It should be the happiest place in the world, and yet it's such a sad place. Why is that true? What's going on? What's wrong? I have a theory, and it's a theory that has no basis whatsoever. Maybe it's about similar to many theories that we hear today. Some of them they call scientific even, but it has no basis. In fact, I'm going to tell you a piece of history that never happened. I assume you know that that's not the definition of history. Piece of history. About 175 years ago, there was a Jewish businessman, very sharp businessman, and he had a brilliant idea to make fortunes of money. He goes over to his scientist friend, and he says to him, he says, if you can come up with some way of convincing people that there are a bunch of accidents, that they're here in this world by accident, he says, we can cash in. We'll make fortunes of money. Now, if you haven't guessed, these two people are not fictitious, but this agreement between them most likely is. The businessman, I would say his name was Sigmund Freud. The scientist, I would suggest his name was Charles Darwin. And what they came up with was a brilliant plan. If Darwin can come up with a theory that will tell all of us that we're here just by accident, that's a very oversimplification of the theory of evolution, very oversimplified, I'm aware of that. And then if we're all here by accidents, then we have no purpose. If we have no sense of purpose, how can we be happy? What am I doing here? What is it worth? Why must I suffer so much? Oh, it's all about having fun and frolic and having pleasure. But you know something? After a short while, sometimes it takes months, sometimes it takes years, but it doesn't take decades. But soon people realize there has to be more to life than just partying. There has to be more to life than just having fun. There has to be more to life than just having thrills. Because if there's no meaning and no purpose in my life, how can I possibly be happy? And that, the truth of the matter is what we find in our Lashon HaKodesh. You know, we have a unique language. Our language is different from every other language in the world. In every language, this is called a table because of some people agreed to call it a table. And this is called a recorder because some people agreed to call it so, and so forth and so on. A chair, they call it by convention. Not so the Lashon HaKodesh. In Lashon HaKodesh, the three-letter root of the word describes the meaning of the concept. And every time those three letters appear as the shirish, the root of a word, they implant that concept in the word. One of the highest forms of happiness is osher. David HaMelech said, Acha shoalti me'eis Hashem oisu avakesh. I have one request, shivti be'eis Hashem, to sit in the house of Hashem. And David HaMelech said about that, Ashrei yoshvei be'secho. Osher, Aleph, Shin, Reish, is maybe the highest form of happiness. The shirish of the word comes from the word ishur, le'asher, to validate. Happiness is defined in its true definition as feeling good about myself. How can I feel good about myself? Well, one thing I know for sure, if I don't know what my purpose in life is, or if I believe this scientist and entrepreneur that made up this deal that I have no purpose in life because I'm here by an accident, then you can't possibly be happy, because I have to feel good about myself. No one can feel good about himself without a sense of purpose. Now, not only that, our society has taught us another false equation. Happiness equals
money.
That's okay. I'm looking for something. Maybe it's good, maybe it's bad, maybe worse. Happiness equals pleasure, right? Money is nothing. You want pleasure from the money. Otherwise, what's the money for? Happiness equals pleasure. You know something? Nothing can be further from the truth. Because pleasure doesn't make me feel good about myself. Pleasure sends a negative message. Pleasure says, oh, you need this, that, and the other thing in order to get through the day. You don't feel good about yourself. You don't have a sense of meaning and purpose in your life. It sends a negative message, and this, I believe, is why our society today is going through such depressive states, is going through such suicide rates, that the mental health professionals are able to charge so much because of the fact that we have accepted that false equation of pleasure equals happiness, rather than realizing that the more that we become dependent upon outside pleasures, the more we send the message to ourselves, I am not worth anything. I don't feel valid. I don't feel good about myself. And therefore, we end up in a depressed state. What can we do about it? I think that you people are very fortunate. I think we, as Jews, are very fortunate. Because we have a situation in the world where we can truly be happy in the truest, most real sense of the word. Why? Well, you know, people for thousands of years prior to this event, well, it really wasn't an event, I said, but prior to Darwin and his theory of accidental existence, if you permit me to call it that. Prior to that, everybody knew there was a creator. There was no question about it. Who was he? We're not sure. Where can we find him? We don't know. Why did he create the world? We don't know. What's our purpose here? We don't know. But there's hope! Because if there's a creator, maybe we will discover the purpose for which we were created. Because if there's a creator, then there is a purpose for which he created us. And there was hope. Came along, of course, this theory of accidental existence and shattered the hope of all those people that subscribe to it, because if they don't know that there's a creator, then there can't be any purpose. But when the world was looking for purpose, do you know where most of the civilized world looked? Very interestingly, they looked in the Bible. In fact, I find it shocking that to this day, every time I go into a hotel and I open up the drawer, usually in the desk or the night table, I find a copy of the Gideon Bible. It's the Christian Bible, and it has what they call the New Testament. But they print religiously, faithfully, with a reasonably good translation, the entire Tanakh, the Jewish Bible, what they call the Old Testament. Very interesting. This seems to be the basis for most, or certainly the biggest and the most well-known religions in the world. Now, I have a number of questions about that. Why should they do that? Why should they bother reprinting our Bible? Question number one. Question number two, which is even a stronger question, why is it that reading the Bible, last week's parsha, and seeing Moshe Rabbeinu's attitude when Hashem comes and tells him, tell the Jewish people that I appeared to you and that I'm going to take you out of Egypt, and Moshe says, they're not going to believe me. Et lo yaminu li. Private revelation. God appeared to you. Tell me another joke. You know, but they base their religions on that. And God appeared to one the angel appeared to one in upstate New York in a hotel room and gave him this volume. He appeared to somebody else on the road to Damascus. He appeared to someone else in a dream. Major religions. And why? The Bible that they all have access to says people don't really take private revelation seriously. Yeah, you can get a couple of people to believe it, and then they convince a couple more people, and over hundreds and hundreds of years, but it's not a reality. Anyone who thinks logically says, how can I believe that when it all starts with one person? But I believe that's the reason that they have to record the Old Testament in their books as well, because if there wasn't an event that the world knows that can't be denied, that God speaks to man, because he spoke to millions of people and it was recorded and it was passed down from generation to generation to this very day, eyewitness testimony to these events, after having seen the most miraculous events in Egypt where they saw literally the Creator in action. And then he introduces himself at Sinai and says, I'm the one, Anochi Hashem Elokecha. That's something that they all need, because otherwise this private revelation, which is incredulous to begin with, would be totally outlandish, because not only should we not believe you that God spoke to you privately, but God doesn't speak to people. Who ever heard of such a thing? But the world knows it to be true because it happened at Sinai, and the whole world knows that. And that's why even those people who are inventing a new religion, they record this event, because otherwise their private revelations would be meaningless. So we're very fortunate. We know that the Creator spoke to us at Sinai. We know he revealed to us the purpose of creation. We know that he gave us the formula for true happiness in this world. How does that work? Let's just highlight maybe just a few ideas. If happiness is about feeling good about myself, what type of a person would I want myself to be? One word. Simple. I just said it. Well, no. If happiness is about feeling good about myself, then what would I want myself to be? Good. I want to be good so I can feel good. I feel good about myself. Hashem gave us at Sinai a formula for making ourselves into better people. Do you know that the Chazal and the Medrash say, they ask the following question. They say, "Chimaich b'slei laKodesh Baruch Hu." What does Hashem care if you put tefillin on over here or over here? What does Hashem care if you shech the animal from the front or from the back? He says, all of the mitzvahs, every one of them, were all given just to refine human character. Torah refines human character. If happiness is about feeling good about myself, and if the mitzvahs of the Torah can refine my character, and not just refine my character in a general sense, but make me godly, take out the impurities, and set a standard for human behavior, just like Hashem is merciful and kind, Rachum v'chanun, Erech Hapayim v'Rav Chesed, Afato, we are to emulate, we are to act, we are to develop our personality and our characters in the image of Hashem. I am godly? Wow. I certainly have to feel good about myself. What could me be more good than being godly? What could be more good than removing all the impurities? And when I connect with Hashem, with the performance of the mitzvahs, then what I'm doing to myself is I'm reminding myself, there's a God, and he has given us a program to refine our character, to make ourselves into better human beings. You know, there's a very strange Sifri. The Sifri is brought, Rashi brings it in Parshas Bahar. And the Sifri says, the Pasuk says over there about if a Jew is sold to a non-Jew as a slave. So it's a special warning to him that he should not emulate, he should not be like his master and say, just like my master is an idol worshiper, I want to be. Just like my master is a Mechal Shabbos, I want to be. The Torah writes a special Pasuk. No, even though you're owned by a master, you're obligated to Hashem. And I find it to be the strangest thing in the world. Why, if I had a master who's not necessarily so nice to me, because we're not talking about an every where you have to, if you have only one pillow, you have to share it with him. This non-Jew owns a slave now and treats him as a slave, as nice as he might be. I want to be like him. That's my idol. That's my image in life. That's my goal. And I think the answer is very simple. In fact, in psychology, they have a term for it. They call it the Stockholm syndrome. When a person is obligated to someone, he craves, he wants, he desires to identify with that person, to identify with the one who obligates him. The Torah has given us obligations. Our obligations to Hashem, our obligations set up in us a craving. I want to be like Hashem. I want to emulate His ways. I don't want to be a liar. I don't want to be a cheater. I don't want to be a cruel person. I don't want to be evil. I don't want to be nasty to people. I want to be kind and loving and caring and truthful, just like the Creator Himself. And that's what the Torah does and the mitzvahs do to refine our character and make us into better people. There's a very, very interesting comment, and I believe that it would help us to understand it. You know, people wonder, what's the benefit of learning? Such an emphasis in Judaism is put on learning. We're the people of the book. And it's not only because we introduce the book to society, but we study the book and we live by the book. And there's such an emphasis in Judaism on studying, learning Torah. Why is it so powerful? Why is it so important? Why is it so significant? And there's a very interesting Mishnah and a comment by the Rabbeinu Simcha. Rabbeinu Simcha is in the Machzeh Vitri. The Mishnah says, "Yofe Talmud Torah im derech eretz, she yegia shnei mashkachas ovoin." It's good to learn Torah and to have a source of parnosa, have a source of livelihood, because the effort put into both will cause a person not to sin. And Rabbeinu Simcha explains that the work we're talking about, making a living, and the Talmud Torah that he's talking about is learning the laws of stealing. When one learns the laws against zela, against stealing, and he has a parnosa, he won't come to steal because he knows how wrong it is. He studied the halachas, and he has a parnosa, so he's not so needy. Such a person will be assured that he's not going to steal. But the question is, the Mishnah's lashon is yegia shneim mashkachas ovoin, causes it to be forgotten. What's forgotten? He won't see him. Forgotten? It seems that the study of Torah has an enormous power on us. And that's the secret of how the Jew has remained the greatest when it comes to tzedakah, and when it comes to chesed, organizations that are doing chesed, and everything that we do, even those of us that have drifted from Yiddishkeit, but these values are so much part of us. Because the study of halacha makes the inappropriate behavior beyond anything that I can think of. I often ask this question, and please don't give me an answer. Who in this group has ever thought of murdering someone? I didn't like some of those smiles. Please don't answer. Don't incriminate yourself, unless it's past the statute of limitations. No, there's no statute of limitations on murder, probably. Anyway, okay, so now, why not? Oh. That's a hard question. Why not? The Torah says it's beyond what we can think of. It's forgotten to us. That's something that's out of our realm. How many of us have ever thought to speak a little Lashon Hara? Or to cheat a little bit? Or to lie a little? No, please don't raise that. Don't self-incriminate. You know, that's something that's within our world. The Torah, when we study Hashem's Torah, it purifies us. If we study the laws of Gzela, Gzela becomes something that I just can't think of it. It's forgotten to me. It doesn't exist. And the same thing with all that we learn. And when we learn Hashem's Torah, we are obligating ourselves to follow Him. We are connecting with Him and refining our character. And the specific areas that we are studying are helping us to become better people, because it's not only that we choose not to act that way, but it becomes it's second nature. How can I do such a thing? I study the Hilchus Gzela. How can I steal? I study the laws of Shabbos. How can I violate the Shabbos? I study the laws of Lashon Hara. How can I speak Lashon Hara? And it becomes, the more that we study, the more we refine the human character. And I must say that if we want to be happy, and if we want to feel good about ourselves, there's only one way, and that's to be a better person. And if the Torah refines us to become better people, then that is the source of our happiness, and that can literally change our whole attitude in life. But I appreciate the message. Thank you. And that is as follows. The teenage years in our society are very difficult. You, teenagers today, have been and continue to be exposed to a world that is unbelievable. It seems so alluring. It seems so exciting. It seems so attractive. But the reality is, speak to the people who have gone through it for 10 years and for 15 years, maybe not more, and they tell you. People come to me almost every day. Just not too long ago, an individual came. He says, I'm 40 years old. I'm very wealthy. I'm a doctor, my wife is a doctor. I have a beautiful home, I have a wonderful family. I have every measure of success by all standards. And I'm empty inside. I don't feel any meaning in my life. This is a reality. And it's only when we recognize that there is a purpose to our existence, that the Creator created us with that purpose, and He privileged us with the knowledge of that purpose beyond any ability to doubt it, because of the fact that there was a public revelation. Right now, maybe you can't fully appreciate this. Right now, maybe the outside attractions are going to draw you in many different directions and create challenges. But the time will come in the near future, and make it sooner than later, when we all come to realize that after everything is said and done, if my life doesn't have true meaning and purpose, I can't possibly be happy. And if I'm not going to be happy in this life, then what is it really all about?